fire currently burning southwest of Happy Camp in the Klamath National Forest. It's roughly 2,900 acres, 60% contained. Things are rather quiet on the wildfire front in our region, which gives us a chance to talk more broadly about fire and its management and its uses on wildlands. So we bring in Stephen Pine, Stephen J. Pine, who's a Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. He teaches courses on fire, environmental history, and the history of exploration. He's written many books on fire, with additional books on the Voyager mission to space, Antarctica, and the Grand Canyon, among other subjects. Stephen Pine, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, Steve, I noticed that right after high school, you joined a fire crew. What prompted you to do that in the first place?
Well, it was a fluke. I got a job as a laborer at Grand Canyon. Showed up at the South Rim. I would probably be patching roads, picking up garbage, whatever. But they had a cancellation. One of the guys on the fire crew in the North Rim called and he couldn't come. I'm there signing my papers. They asked, "Do you want to go?" I'm 18. What do I know? Sure. So I went over and loved it. It was a completely different world, and I returned for 15 summers and all.
So what were some of the key questions or key fascinations you had with fire at that point as you first started out as a firefighter?
Well, it was just it was a wholly different kind of life. I mean, I'd grown up in a Phoenix suburb. I went to a Jesuit high school. I did well. I played a few little sports, but was really going to middle upper middle class white collar career, and suddenly I'm plunged into what is really a very blue collar sort of grunt vocational world. And this is all about chainsaws and shovels and axes. And I tell you frankly, I think a shovel's the only thing I've ever understood in my life. But it was an extraordinary place. I mean, we live literally on the rim of the Grand Canyon, and we're going to all these exotic places. We're getting paid for it. We're putting out fires. We're flying helicopters around and down in for odd fires. I mean, it was just a great life. And at that age, you're susceptible to those kinds of suggestions, and so that really stayed with me.
It's funny you call it a blue-collar profession. I mean, it certainly is that, but I think of it more as a black-collar kind of profession.
Well, it's certainly the educational level has steadily increased, and it was starting at that point. But really, this was just grunt labor. I mean, we're out there digging line, moving firewood, we're clearing trails. We're just out there wherever they need something that – or you don't want a ranger with dirt on his – or soot on his uniform. So we got called. And so it was a pretty varied life. It was very different. Now fire crews, particularly since the National Fire Plan, are much more technically trained. They're much more semi-professional in a way, but also much more restricted in what they do and how they live. We had crews made up of all kinds of people. We had one crew. We had Ed Abbey was our lookout for a couple of years. So we had a guy who later became mayor of Salt Lake City. I mean, we had people who did all kinds of stuff, and that's not so much the case now.
Did you consider staying with firefighting as a full-fledged career? Because you have gone on. I mean, you've been a professor for a long time now.
Yeah. No, that was very much an option. I got my doctorate. I never studied fire in school. There were two different lives. I mean, summer would come, I'd put all my books away, pick up my boots and gloves, go fight fire.
Then
I'd have enough of that. Uh-huh. And then I'd say, okay, now I go back. I'll go back to school and concentrate on that. So it was great. But I never studied fire. And so I went on, got my doctorate, wrote a biography of an American geologist, an explorer. And I thought that would be it. But I really decided, I mean, there were no jobs. This was 76. I decided, why not write about the thing that really excited me and try to bring these two lives together? And so that was the insight. Try to do for fire what I'd learned to do with other subjects. And nobody was really doing that. And in some ways, nobody still is.
So what is your approach to writing about fire? And you've written, what, 20, is it 20 books altogether?
Oh, I've written a couple dozen books altogether. But the ones on fire, mostly I see it as cultural history, cultural in the older sense of the term, that it's about the interaction of people in nature with mediated through fire. I mean, we are a uniquely fire creature on the planet. I mean, other animals, knock over trees, dig holes in the ground.
Right.
We do fire. This is our ecological signature. We're the keystone species for the fire on the planet. We have a species monopoly over it. And so that's a pretty interesting way to decide who are we. Ecologically, this is our signature. So in that way, you begin looking at, well, how do people do it? What kinds of institutions? What kind of ideas do they – how do they understand it? What kind of art do they create? So –
I'm curious to know, though. I mean, it seems like throughout human history there would have been parallel tracks of knowledge of fire in wild lands, knowledge of its use and fear of it at the same time. Have those tracks always existed?
They've always existed, and it's really not until we get to modern industrial societies that the whole process becomes completely unhinged. So despite all our mechanical firepower, our science, and the rest of it, we seem unable to be able to live with fire in ways that we had for, 200,000 years.
So unhinged, but you mean in terms of fear is what you mean?
Well, not just in terms of fear, but being able to manage it, to live with it somehow, to work with it. We've never had full control over it, but we never tried to until fairly recently. And now we're learning that we've got to somehow work with fire. We went through this experiment. It was actually a global experiment tied to European imperialism and the spread of forestry as the vanguard of what we might call state-sponsored conservation that decided fire had to be eliminated. And that experiment failed. It certainly makes sense in cities. You don't want free-burning flame around. But otherwise, we took out good fires as well as bad fires, and we're living with the consequences. We've spent the last 50 years trying to find some way to put good fire back in, but it turns out to be a lot easier to take something out than – a lot easier to wreck something than to build it.
It's an interesting oscillation, too, that you point out, and we'll have to get to that when we come back from a break. We're talking to Stephen Pine, who has written 24 books and a whole bunch about fire, and he is in Ashland, brought in by the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project to speak tonight at 7 at the Meese Auditorium at the Arts Center on the Southern Oregon University campus in Ashland. Free and open to the public, Stephen Pine will be our guest on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Talking to Stephen Pine from Arizona State University, a fire expert who has written a number of books about fire. He'll be talking in Ashland tonight about wildfire and the history of it and the use of it. Brought into town by the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project. That'll be tonight at 7 at the Meese Auditorium on the Southern Oregon University campus. You can join us as we discuss fire here and now on the program, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So how far back in time, Steve, have you studied fire?
Well, the first fossil fire is about 420 million years ago. So as soon as plants colonized the land, they began to burn, and they've been burning ever since. So I don't personally research that. I consume that kind of research. So I'm interested in the whole history of fire on the planet, but there's a real phase change when a species, actually a genus and now just a species, got the ability to manipulate fire, and suddenly everything starts changing. And then it changes hugely again when that species decides to burn lithic landscapes, if you will, rather than living ones. That is, we begin deriving our firepower from fossil fuels and finding ways to substitute for open flame. So the consequences of that are that we take out a lot of fires that we had put in before, and we begin trying to control fire in a larger way. So those two human tipping points are particularly interesting for me.
Is there any culture in history that you think either had it just about right in terms of how it used fire or horribly wrong?
Well, I think we know about the horribly wrong ones. It's harder to know those who got it right, except that if there didn't seem to be any huge environmental upheaval related to it, then they were probably doing okay. And there are lots. And we've got to remember that human groups were living hundreds, in many cases thousands, in some cases tens of thousands of years on landscape that are very fire-prone. They obviously used fire. They were subjected to fire from outside, and they managed to come through it okay. And we begin seeing the real wreckage, partly because of the kinds of records we keep, but the real wreckage comes, I think, with industrialization. And we break our connections to fire intellectually. Practically, we're no longer heating our houses, cooking food with fire. We're no longer using fire in daily life, much less in farms and fields. And it just becomes more and more remote. We become more and more urban. And at that point, fire is a threat, or it's just it's a kind of a theater, a kind of wild theater that occurs out there. and it's okay because it's way out there.
So it sounds like it took, in the process of westward expansion, it took us a long time to figure out that fire was a natural part of the ecosystem. But then again, we weren't even talking in terms of ecosystems then, were we?
Well, there's certainly plenty of wreckage if we want to do that with settlement. And the record of really the chronicle of large conflagrations really begins with land clearing, beginning 1825 all the way into really the 1930s. So land clearing for settlement, always tied with logging. Eventually there's logging itself. The amount of slash that was left, debris left, the need and use of open fire for all kinds of purposes. This was really a volatile combination and caused lots of really bad fires. So it wasn't just a settlement. And, you know, most people along the frontier and most people living in agricultural settings thought fire was fine. They didn't like bad fires that occasionally boiled over. But they had no problem with fire. And there was a very intense debate 100 years ago in the United States called the light burning controversy, which right at the foundations of the Forest Service was arguing that this European model of suppressing fire, this kind of paramilitary approach, was all wrong. And they predicted all the forest health, all the fuel buildup problem, everything that we're dealing with now was all laid out publicly a century ago. So it's an interesting controversy. So it was not that people didn't know it. They used it in their daily life. They didn't want to be denied access to fire. And then it was, in a sense, taken away. And now there's a movement, a landowner's right to burn, with some kind of, you know, social and legal parameters set around it, but an attempt to recover some of those old connections.
We're talking to Stephen Pine on the Jefferson Exchange. We are inviting your calls as we talk about fire and its history and its uses here on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's George in Wairika. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you very much. I don't want to say how old I am, but when I was very, very young, my grammar school teacher said, go interview the oldest people you know and come back and write up your understanding for the Siskiyou Historical Society. And I interviewed a lady whose memory was when she and her family were leaving the backwoods to go to the big town of Etna for the winter, her dad let her set fire to each of the hills as they left the valley, as the Indians did. And we thought that was horrible, the way that they nurtured fire instead of putting it out entirely. That's all. Thank you.
All right, great story. Thanks for that, George. Appreciate it. That's a very American story, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's very, very typical, not only in the U.S., but everywhere that sort of European forestry went. I mean, this is how people lived. And they knew when to do it, when not to, where. And all that kind of traditional knowledge, which was often built out of hundreds or thousands of years of experience, was lost.
There must have been people along the way saying, you know, you realize that by putting these fires out, we're leaving a lot of fuel out there that's going to burn later. And if it does burn, it's going to burn a lot hotter. So, I mean, when did those voices begin to be heard?
Well, that is an interesting debate. It gets into the literature when forestry becomes institutionalized. It requires a political character. The earliest public discussion I can think of is in the 1870s in India. British India brought a forestry administration in, and this was part of their rationalizing and modernizing of India, part of the justification for their presence. And they had a debate, and all of the political leaders, the academics, all of the elite argued we have to control fire. It's impossible to manage the landscape as long as you have this sort of laissez-faire populist burning going on, and it was just endless. But all the people in the field said, this is crazy. If you do this, you're going to have bigger fires because it's going to build up, and they predicted everything. So even before the U.S., 40 years before the U.S. has a debate, it's in the literature. The British have gone through this, and it always comes down to the same dichotomy and the same decisions, that politically and sort of intellectually, we can't relinquish control over that.
Letting nature take its course is not a way.
That's right, but not even letting nature, because people were setting those fires. And it's controlling the populations. So there's a certain fear of that. So there are a couple of things, and it was just deeply, deeply embedded in temperate Europe, that is Central Europe, which has no natural basis for fire. It's one of the oddball areas of the world in that. Most areas have some kind of wet, dry cycle, and temperate Europe does not. But that was the heartland of forestry and European thinking of agronomy, which one of its graphs was forestry. And so they assumed that was normative. It wasn't. So they go, all these other places of the world, they're overwhelmed with burning. They can't cope with it. They can't understand it. They need to put it out so that they can maintain control over the land and hence over the people.
Stephen Pine is a fire expert, written a number of books, including Between Two Fires, which we'll talk about in just a moment. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your observations and questions about how we use fire in the natural landscape. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I'm curious to see in your work that you talk about, and I think you did mention already, that we kind of knew what to do by the 1960s, how fire could be used in the ecosystem. But there was a counter-revolution, you point out in your work.
Well, there was a change. The federal agencies, it began in the 1960s with the creation of what I think of as a civil society for fire, wresting the debate about fire away from sort of the public sector and letting private citizens begin to have a voice. So the Tall Timbers Research Station begins holding a series of conferences, very important event. Nature Conservancy begins burning in prairies. They become involved. And by 1968, the National Park Service reformed its policy to allow restoration of fire in various forms. 10 years later, the Forest Service follows after a series of sort of intermediate steps. So that by 1978, essentially, the policy arrangement, the institutional apparatus is on board. It's amazing how fast the old order collapsed. I mean, it's like watching the Berlin Wall come down. One day it's there. It's going to be there for 1,000 years. The next day it's gone. And you realized how hollow the arguments were and that even the people doing it realized this was misguided. But then how do you actually make it happen on the ground? A lot of things come in, but basically it's politics, national politics. And there's a shift, not directly on fire, but indirectly at environmental legislation, which had also grown up concurrently, all of which had previously been bipartisan. Also a shift from civilian funding to military. There's a large governmental shift associated with the Reagan administration coming in and a reaction to a lot of the environmental reforms, of which fire is a part. So
a lot of like, we're going to do things differently now.
Yeah, we're going to roll this back. Mm-hmm. And that sets up a big counter-reaction among environmental groups. So the whole thing starts being paralyzed, and it ends up in the Northwest with the timber wars becoming more and more intense. The reason this matters is not just for fire per se, but because the Forest Service becomes progressively dysfunctional, even disabled. But for historical reasons, the whole national infrastructure had built up around the Forest Service. And if you remove that, the pieces don't connect. And so there's been a huge effort to try to find ways to create a new national order without having the Forest Service there. And it takes a long time. So they aren't able to roll – the kind of revolutionaries, if you will, aren't able to roll back the reforms, but there's no progress. And it doesn't start up again until really 93, 94. 94 season is the catalytic year. But by then, everything has changed. I think the 70s and early 80s were really the last chance where all sort of the planets were aligned in terms of climate, fuels, institutional interest, to where you could have, on a large scale, begun to put fire back in some ways. We lost that. And since then, we've been trying to play catch-up, basically.
Is it too late then? I mean, do you think that to introduce fire in some places?
Well, we've had successes. I mean, there are places that have sort of refounded it, but they tend to be local. I mean, fire is local. The problem is trying to think when you start thinking nationally and you start homogenizing all these different pieces, you lose the local success stories. But I think it's safe to say there's a whole lot less than the 60s revolutionaries had expected. and wanted, and in a sense, a lot less than we might have expected. There's a lot going on, but the scale is still worrisome. I mean, we've got lots of proof of concepts. We've got lots of small-scale stuff, but we really need – we probably need an order of magnitude, maybe two orders of magnitude scaling up. So I think what I see going on now, particularly in the Western U.S., is that the recognition that on scale, large prescribed burning and the preparations that it often requires in terms of thinning or other management techniques have just become too costly and cumbersome. And they're going to, well, we don't have a good term for it, but a kind of managed wildfire where they're taking fires, whatever origin, and trying to work with them. And actively engage, not just standing back and say, "Well, we'll let it go until it looks like it's out of control." No, they're right there. They are putting more fire in. They're pushing it here. They're pulling it back there. They're trying to work with it to get some of their burning done, but also maintain control. So we're not burning into communities. We're not threatening municipal watersheds. We're not going to burn down sequoia groves. But other than selective areas with high value assets, I don't see how in the West you're going to come close to getting this. So you're going to the future is either uncontrolled wildfire or a kind of semi-controlled riding the tiger wildfire. And I think that we're sort of more going to the overused term resilience, but it's a resilience model rather than what I would think of as a restoration model. We're not going to get ahead of it.
Fire expert Stephen Pine is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So this brings us right up to the doorstep of who brought you to Ashland, which the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project, which we've had them on a number of times here on the program talking about just updates on what's going on. This is an effort to keep wildfire from roaring down the Ashland watershed and messing up the city's water supply ultimately. But as intensive as it is, I mean, is this something that is replicable in other places from what you've seen of it? They are using fire, but they have to clear out so much stuff just to be able to get to the prescribed burns. It seems like it's a costly process.
Well, it is. On the other hand, if you're talking about the city's water supply, it's probably worth the cost. The question would be, outside of that watershed, are you willing? How much are you willing to invest, and for what ends? And I have to say, I say this reluctantly. I'm not a fatalist, but I don't see the money and political, or even social will, there to be able to project that kind of intensive treatment, almost cultivated fire, on scale. So I think we're going to see other options come into play, and partly in the name of firefighter safety, partly in the name of cost, for lots of reasons. But I think in the last 4 or 5 years, we begin to see a change in how these fires are being managed. They're not advertising it very much because they're afraid people will misinterpret it and say, "Well, you're not doing anything." No, they're putting a lot of effort to keep fire out of communities. Communities have got to step up and do their part as well, and protected areas. But otherwise, they're not willing to go toe-to-toe, spend the money, put lives at risk. And, you know, then you just hold off the fires. And, you know, as they say, they're not putting them out, they're putting them off. Yep. So
Boyd in Wolf Creek emails a question here. He says, when restoring our forests after the excesses of industrial forestry, shouldn't we favor late successional forests, big trees?
Well, I like mixed economies, and I like mixed forests and landscapes. If you've got some room, I'd go for a mix of things. Yeah, you want to protect late succession forests, but also they're also going to be vulnerable unless you're willing to invest quite a bit of effort to change the fire environment in which they're existing. But we also need to think about forests for the future. So I think a mix of things is pretty good. And the question then becomes whether we know enough or are capable enough to anticipate that and make it happen, or whether we need to back off and let nature sort some of this out, particularly with climate change and basis, everything else, who knows?
How much should land use planning get involved in fire ideas because of the fact that you have houses being built up right to the edge of the forest, sometimes in it?
Well, that's a great question. In many ways, that was the fundamental issue of what I think of as the fire revolution, that fire had become its own standalone army. Funded by itself, it responded to nothing else. And the point was, fire is in the service of land management. Fire is supposed to be helping us get these lands where we want them to be. So a lot of the problem with fire, we didn't talk about the counter-revolution, is just the confusion and disagreements over what we want those lands to be. What's the appropriate fire? Well, what should that land be? We can't decide. We can't even, in many cases, decide on a procedure by which to decide. So as long as that's happening, fire is just going to do its thing. It's not listening. It doesn't care about court injunctions, congressional resolutions, or any of the rest of it. So that's it. If your primary land use is urban sprawl, then you want something like CAL FIRE. If your primary land use is something like a kind of wildland setting, then you want a very different approach that will grow out of that land use.
And Stephen Pine has seen all those approaches. He's a very well-known fire historian, speaking tonight at 7 at the Mies Auditorium at the Arts Complex at Southern Oregon University. It is free and open to the public. Steve, thanks so much for joining us on the Exchange.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good to have you.